You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
Carmen Aguirre is a well-known theater artist in Vancouver. She has written and co-written 14 plays, often drawing her material from her personal experience as a Latina living between two cultures. But many people familiar with Carmen Aguirre's career in Vancouver will be surprised to find out that she, along with her mother and stepfather, was an underground member of the Chilean resistance during the 1980s. Something Fierce is the title of Carmen Aguirre's memoir of life during this dark period in Latin American history. And Carmen joins me in the studio this morning to talk about her book. Hello, Carmen.
Hello.
Now, the book covers the time from 1979 to 1989. What was the significance of that period in your life?
Well, two things. First of all, 1979 is when the Return Plan, which was the name of a plan installed by the Chilean resistance in exile, asked Chilean resistance members living in exile and internationalists who had joined the Chilean resistance abroad go back into Chile to resist Pinochet's dictatorship. So that's the significance of that time period. And in terms of my personal life, it was kind of the coming of age time. It was the ages of 11 to 21.
And so your mother and your stepfather returned not to Chile. Where did they go back to?
First of all, to Bolivia and then to Argentina.
And what was the nature of the work that they were involved in there?
The resistance movement that they belonged to and that I later belonged to believed in a armed revolution in order to install a socialist government in Chile. It was inspired by the triumph of the Cuban Revolution in 1959, like many movements in Latin America were inspired by the triumph of that revolution. In the 60s, many revolutionary movements came to be in Latin America. So the nature of what they were doing is there was a need to get as many people into Chile as possible. Most of the people that were going to go into Chile were on the blacklist. At that time, the Pinochet dictatorship was considered one of the most secure, quote-unquote, dictatorships in the world, so pretty hard to get through those borders. Consequently, a lot of people in the resistance were asked to stay in the three bordering countries, Peru, Bolivia, and Argentina, run safe houses for people going in and out of Chile, and actually get them into Chile. So when we were in Bolivia, we were helping people go through, go into Chile through the Atacama Desert in the north. And when we were in Argentina, in southern Argentina, we were helping people go through the Andes Mountains, which is very similar to Banff or, yeah, the Rocky Mountains.
Now, Latin America then and Latin America now were completely different politically, and it was a very dangerous time to be in Bolivia doing that kind of work.
Yes. At that time in Bolivia, when we arrived in Bolivia, there was a dictatorship, right-wing dictatorship. 2 months after we got there, there was a coup. And then about 8 months after that, there was another coup. That one was by the infamous Luis García Mesa, who said that Pinochet was his idol, whose right-hand man was Klaus Barbie, the infamous Nazi living in Bolivia at the time. García Mesa stayed in power for not for that long, but the neoliberal economy, that was the whole reason why most of Latin America was under right-wing dictatorships in the 70s and 80s, remained intact, and the social cost of that economy was huge.
Now, you write your book, as you say, you were a child in 1979, and so you were 11 years old, you're a young teenager while this is happening. How did that affect your life?
Well, it was, here's the thing, right? All children think that their life is normal, no matter what situation they're in. So to me, it was kind of normal, I suppose, right? And also, I was used to being completely... Okay, so you asked me how it affected my life. Basically, telling absolute bald-faced lies to everybody you meet, you know, saying you were not born, you know, changing the place where you were born, saying your stepfather is your father when he's not your father, all kinds of BS, basically. However, that wasn't entirely foreign to me because I did spend a lot of my childhood in Canada as a child of political refugees. And in mainstream Canada, which in my experience was the school that I went to, you just learned very quickly not to talk about what was actually going down in your country or why you had arrived here, because I very quickly gained a reputation from the time I was about 7 years old in my school and even in my neighborhood as crazy. Like literally, oh, she's crazy. Just because I would talk about my uncles and aunts who would come to visit the house who had just come from a concentration camp, right? So I was already very used to living, for lack of a better term, a double life. And even today, I will bump into old classmates who will apologize to me and go, I thought you were completely crazy and a liar until I saw the movie Missing with Jack Lemmon and Sissy Spacek. That's when I went, oh, they really did use the National Stadium as a concentration camp. So
it's interesting because you talk about seeing that movie with your mother and how you were just like, that's our life, and it's on the screen, and finally mm-hmm. people know.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, we watched it in Rio, it was completely banned in Bolivia and in Chile, that movie, but it was like the hottest, how do you say that, pirate tape going around in Chile at that time. So we got to watch it on the screen, which was a very big deal.
Now, after your mother and stepfather were forced to return to Canada because it simply became too dangerous for them to do the work that they were doing, you came back and then you returned once again to work in the Chilean resistance in Argentina. You were still very young. Was it 18 at that time?
18, yes.
What led you to make that decision to go back?
Well, I mean, I never wanted to leave to begin with. So it was, I was just very unhappy to be back in Canada when I really just wanted to be in Latin America. So to me, it was, sounds ridiculous maybe, like, but there was no choice. I mean, I'm not going to sit there and not do anything. I want to be able to look at my son when he's older and when he looks at me and says, what did you do during that dictatorship? I can look at him now and go, well, this is what I did. As opposed to I was a coward who did nothing. And I'm not saying that people who did nothing are cowards. I'm just talking about my own personal reason as to why I did what I did.
Yeah. And when you went back there, what kind of work did you do?
Basically, I was married at the time to a fellow resistance member, and we set up shop, as it were, in Neuquén, which is an Argentinian city very close to the border with Chile in Patagonia. We also ran a safe house. I did a lot of border runs by land, that is to say on buses, in and out of Chile, carrying stuff. And then we both took piloting lessons, and the goal was for us to become pilots and to make the border runs much, much easier.
Now, you write in a totally compelling way about your constant fear, interspersed with periods of real terror, during your time in Argentina. What made it possible for you to continue doing that work at such a high personal cost?
Knowing that what we were fighting for was not... here's the thing, right? We weren't fighting, as far as I was concerned, for civil rights. To me, that's kind of middle class. So you can't say what you want. You don't have freedom of expression. Who cares? We were fighting for basic human rights, you know, for the right to eat, for the right to health, for the right to shelter, for the right to clean water, which under Pinochet, a vast, vast number of people did not have. So for me, it was until that stops, the struggle must continue, right? And we saw it at that time as the answer at that time to those questions was socialism. Do I still believe that? Yes, I do. You know, when the Berlin Wall fell, when the Soviet Union collapsed, capitalism won over Stalinist communism. In my eyes, it did not win over all the other struggles going on in the world, which had absolutely nothing to do with Soviet or Stalinist communism. So that's what kept me going. Yeah.
Is it dangerous to tell this story now?
Well, I think so. So that was a long journey for me because I have a child. I have a 4-year-old son. I'm a single mother. I had to kind of get over that. Yeah.
I mean, you say you've been writing the book in your head for 20 years and yeah. only recently found the courage to write it. What changed?
Basically, what happened is when Bob, my stepfather, died, I guess that was 7 years ago. In the months leading up to his death, he basically really championed the thought of writing the book. Many people, not just him, have asked me to write the book. As far as I can tell, and I've done a lot of research on this, I don't think anybody from the Chilean resistance, certainly not in the English language, has written a book about that time in the first person. And a lot of people are dying, and the stories are going with them. So I thought it was important.
Often people write their memoirs later in life than you have. This means that most of the people you write about are still alive, and in many cases living in Vancouver. How did that impact your process of writing?
It was very hard. There's people in my family who are not pleased with this. You know, they say that you have to make art as if your parents were dead, and that's kind of hard to do for me. So, yeah, I mean, the other thing is that as an artist, you've got to be ruthless, otherwise don't do it, right? So I just had to really call upon that ruthless part of me and go, I know why I'm writing this. I'm sorry if it's going to hurt you, and it's not my intention to hurt you.
And yet you have had a lot of support from people, other people, in terms of your writing of the book.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, unbelievable response to the press that's already been out there on the book, you know, from absolute strangers who come forward and tell you their own personal stories with this kind of, who have similar experiences. And it's been... it has always been considered self-centered and bourgeois and individualistic to talk about yourself and to talk in the first person when you are fighting for a struggle. I don't know that that's healthy. And I know that that still happens in a lot of social movements. So I also had to really fight against that voice in me that kept saying, oh, it's all about you, isn't it? That's why you're writing this book, right? But my point is that a lot of people who are involved in movements right now here in Canada have come forward to me personally with personal stories, saying that they have not felt comfortable to speak those stories out loud.
You're going to read from the beginning of the book?
Yes. Now, as I was saying to you earlier, I don't think I've read this out loud before, so this will be an interesting experience.
You get to be at the premiere then.
Okay, so you want me to just start reading the
first couple of paragraphs? Yes, now this is from the very first page of the book.
Okay. As my mother bit into her Big Mac, her glasses caught the reflection of a purple neon light somewhere behind me. Barry White's Love's Theme, my favorite song, blasted from the loudspeaker. Mommy looked hilarious in her new aqua eyeshadow. Her plucked eyebrows gave her a surprised expression. Then there was her frosted pink lipstick, which was smeared across her chin now, and the unfamiliar scent of Charlie. I'd helped her choose that perfume. The picture on the box showed one of Charlie's angels doing the splits in midair, wearing a white pantsuit and platform shoes. In dressing for our trip that morning, my mother had followed her lead, though not the splits part because she was 4'10" and round. Now, here we were in a food court at Los Angeles International Airport, which my mother referred to as LAX. She and I and my sister, Ale, had walked for ages through the terminal, looking for our gate, and the whole time she'd rubbed the palms of her hands into the small of her back, muttering, "Firing squad to the woman-hater who invented heels." It was June, 1979, and the day before, in Vancouver, Mommy had been a hippie. She'd been a hippie for as long as I'd been her daughter, in fact, which was 11 years now. That's why Ale and I had giggled when we saw her this morning, and why we'd been shocked a few weeks earlier when Mommy announced we were going to a mall. She tried on most of the inventory at Susie Cream Cheese before settling on the white polyester pantsuit and some matching platforms at Aggie's. She was usually dressed in frayed jeans with patches on the ass and a pair of old clogs. But this was a special occasion requiring a new wardrobe to go with it, my mother had explained. We'd found her in the kitchen that morning blowing on her toenails, which were wet with red polish, humming Victor Jara's famous song, "The Right to Live in Peace." Our passports were laid out like a fan on the table. The three of us hadn't looked back as we left our basement suite. Canada had taken us in after the coup in Chile 5 years earlier, but my mother had made it clear from day one that the refugee thing in the imperialist North was not for us. So our suitcases had been packed again and our posters of Ho Chi Minh, Salvador Allende, and Tupac Amaru taken down and given away. Rulo drove us to the airport in my mother's orange VW Bug, and Mommy had several attacks of the giggles along the way because he'd only just learned to drive. "Clutch, Rulo, clutch, you idiot," she yelled. I'd never seen Rulo so excited, and I knew it was because he'd get to keep the car from that day on.
Which really shows a sense of humor. I mean, we've been talking about the book, and people listening might think it's a very dark book, but it's also very funny.
Well, I thought so.
What's the title?
What's the meaning of the title? Well, it was something fierce to be involved in something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Carmen.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Carmen Aguirre. Her first book, Something Fierce, has just been published by Douglas and McIntyre. The Vancouver launch of the book will take place at Rhizome Cafe on Thursday, May 19th at 7 p.m.